17 from Canto 3, Chapter 31. Movements of the living entities spoken by the human soul, or the soul that's in the womb of the mother, and finding it pretty precarious, wanting liberation. Moksha. Let me out of here. Translation, fallen into a pool of blood, stool, and urine. Within the abdomen of his mother, his own body scorched by the mother's gastric fire, the embodied soul, anxious to get out, counts his months and prays, "Oh, my Lord, when shall I, a wretched soul, be released from this confinement?" Purport. The precarious condition of a living entity within the womb of his mother is described here on the one side. On one side of where the child is floating is the heat of gastric fire, and on the other side are urine, stool, blood, and discharges. After 7 months, the child, who has regained his consciousness, feels the horrible condition of his existence and prays to the Lord, counting the months until his release. He becomes greatly anxious to get out of the confinement. The so-called civilized man does not take account of this horrible condition of life, and sometimes, for the purpose of sense gratification, he tries to kill the child by methods of contraception or abortion. Interesting word, unserious. Never seen that word used before. Unserious. Not serious. About the horrible condition in the womb, such persons continue in materialism, grossly misusing the chance of the human form of life. Paragraph. The word kripana, dheen, is significant in this verse. Dheen means intelligence, and kripana means miserly. Conditional life is for persons who are of miserly intelligence, or who do not properly utilize their intelligence. In the human form of life, the intelligence is developed, and one has to utilize that developed intelligence to get out of the cycle of birth and death. One who does not do so is a miser. Just like the person who has immense wealth but does not utilize it, keeping it simply to see. The person who does not actually utilize his human intelligence to get out of the clutches of Maya, the cycle of birth and death, is accepted as miserly. The exact opposite of miserly is untara, or very magnanimous. A Brahmana is called Udara because he utilizes his human intelligence for spiritual realization. He uses that intelligence to preach Krishna consciousness for the benefit of the public, and therefore he is magnanimous. Bhagavatam certainly addresses some of the myths of social life and modern life. Oh, how wonderful. Mother with the child in her womb, and smiles and congratulations, and poor mother and poor child. But misery is taken as happiness. So the condition is quite difficult, specifically the condition of being, well, in other sections, that the space is tiny and the body keeps expanding. Prabhupada calls it an airtight bag, and confined and crunched over, and it's specifically mentioned here is after 7 months. Of course, if you look at the next verse, it describes the gestation period as 10 months instead of 9 months. But in any case, at a certain number of months into the life of the child in the womb, they become conscious. Become conscious means, you know, it's not like the soul is, there's zero consciousness until that stage, but it's the stage of susupti, like anesthesia. There's a very elaborate discussion about this in Tattvasandarbha, the three stages: awake, sleep, and deep sleep. And just go there a little bit. Pingalayana Rishi, one of the nine yogendras, explains to King Nimi that even in deep sleep, the soul is conscious. I'll just say it a little bit. They're in the awake state, pretty much awake. And in the awake state, that the subtle body is fully operative. Material intelligence is acting. The mind is acting. The senses are acting. The senses are perceiving. As long as there's eyesight, one can see. As long as there's hearing, one can hear. As long as the instrument of the senses is not broken, then the capacity to perceive is there, and registering in the mind and analyzing with the intelligence. So the subtle body is fully operative. And the subtle body has an operator behind it, just like a computer or a very sophisticated computer, a robot. Behind the robot, there's the operator. With all the detail, the computer doesn't do anything unless there's an operator of the computer. So consciousness, the conscious self, is needed. So all those functions are in waking state, operating at a certain level. And in sleep, certain of the senses, except the hearing sense, become quiet or dormant. Their consciousness is withdrawn from them. And of course it's in degrees, like you can go to sleep lying on your left side and you wake up in the morning lying on your right side and you don't remember rolling from left side to the right side, because the senses are inoperative. And the mind, similarly, is less functional. It's still happening, there's still, but it's very dull and meandering and in a dream state, go from this thought to that thought, sometimes very brief, sometimes very extended, but not sharp and clear. And the faculty of intelligence is similarly dimmed or dull. But false ego is operative, because we think we're in the dream. So that's the subtle body. Again, behind the subtle body is the soul, the operator of the machine. The material energy is compared like that in Bhagavad Gita to a machine. Yantra, Rudhani, Maya. The soul is situated as if on a machine made of Maya, made of the material energy. So there's the gross machine, the subtle machine. Then there's this third state of consciousness, deep sleep. And in the state of deep sleep, everything is suspended. Jiva Goswami explains, that Pipalayana Rishi explains, that even in that state, it's not that the light goes out, meaning the soul is still conscious, but consciousness, because everything else is practically suspended, consciousness is so much withdrawn, they're not. Even false ego is not operative, although it's there, just in something like a suspended state. False ego, material intelligence, material mind, and of course then the senses grouped around the mind. And that deep sleep condition, which is like when someone is under anesthesia or when the soul is within the body of Mahavishnu, or when the soul first enters the womb of a mother for the first number of months, here it's saying seven, it's not registering consciousness. But quickly, suddenly, the soul goes from that susupti state to the conscious state, you know, like so, awake. And there's the soul in this awake condition. Their senses are active, the mind is active, the material intelligence is active. Oh, let me out of here. So specifically the conditions mentioned are on the one side, stool, blood, stool and urine and discharges surrounding the sac of the womb, the embryo within the womb. And the gastric fire. Some mothers are, pregnant mothers are advised not to eat this and eat that. If it increases the gastric fire, it scorches the body of the child, and so certain mild foods, etc., etc. And packed up, if the mother's uncomfortable, imagine the conscious child is how uncomfortable. And in that condition, this prayer is being offered. Let me out of here. I'll be good. I'll serve you. I won't do what I did in my previous life. I'll be good. Because this discussion, this whole chapter, is the consequence of leading a life of fruitive activities. That was chapter 30, adverse fruitive activities. And Shukadeva Goswami is pretty relentless. The next chapter, 32, it just keeps going. You know, when the finally living entity takes birth, then he forgets that he made all these promises and engages in fruitive activity again. Because the tendency is so strong. And the tendency that's so strong is based on two things. An aversion to being submissive to Krishna. Rebellious towards Krishna. Very strong. And I want to enjoy. So it's constitutional for the soul to be enjoying because we're part and parcel of the supreme enjoyer. So that's not wrong. But aversion to the personality of Godhead combined with that desire to enjoy leads to more fruitive activity. It's just default. It's where energy flows. Once again. It mentioned in the purport, second paragraph, are these two words, kripana and udhara. The syllable dhi, just like in buddhi, dhi means intelligence, dhi, intelligence. And there's different kinds, there's material and spiritual. And kripana, dhi, is miserly intelligence, and miserly Prabhupada consistently would use this comparison of a miser who has money, but he doesn't want to use it. He just wants to look at it. Count it, how much do I have, and feel happiness by having so much, making a plan to get some more. There's one congregation member who shared with me that her husband is exactly like that when she heard Prabhupada's description. He doesn't think about Krishna. He doesn't think about anything other than he likes to look at his savings and his earnings and think of how to make more. He could use it for good causes, but that's not how he's thinking. Just get more. That's his happiness. So that's this kripana, miser. They have something very valuable and they don't exactly misuse it, they just look at it. But just looking at it is also misusing. As an example of this, often referred to discussion between Srila Prabhupada and a German professor. Nice, respectful German professor, Durkheim. Many morning walk conversations, Prabhupada and Professor Durkheim, room conversations, many. And there's one in which Professor Durkheim was advocating that the value of knowledge for knowledge's sake, and Prabhupada was disagreeing, not knowledge for knowledge's sake, depends on how knowledge is utilized. And Durkheim was saying, okay, you want to use that knowledge, but the valuable thing itself is the knowledge. And Prabhupada was saying, no, not valuable unless you use it properly. And they had, some cordial disagreement. Prabhupada finally got really heavy, insisted. Exactly on this point. So the human form of life is that wealth, because human form of life comes through the evolutionary process as the consciousness becomes less covered and less covered and less covered and less covered by the evolutionary cycle. So consciousness becomes developed in the evolutionary cycle to its maximum position in the human form of life. And you have this valuable human form of life that's meant for civilization and you don't use it for that. But rather, the default position, if not for that, is for a life of sense gratification, a life of pursuing the temporary. And that's miserly. I like the possibilities that I have with this human form of life to explore and experience and enjoy and all of those things that people like to do, which one of the modes of nature may vary what it looks like, but the spirit behind it is independent enjoyment. And that independent enjoyment is the miserly position. And then there's the magnanimous position, udara, the magnanimous intelligence. Prabhupada doesn't refer to the verse, but the phrase that this, the verse that he's referring to, where Uttara Di is mentioned, is the second canto Bhagavatam, a very famous verse. Akama, Sarvakama, Mokshakama, Uttara Di. There's the phrase, Uttara Di. Timena Bhakti Yogena, Yajeta Purusham Ram. So Bhagavatam is honoring, like a little discussion yesterday about aspiring for liberation, of wanting to get out of this material circumstance. That's a desire. Moksha kama. Kama means desire. Moksha kama is the desire for liberation. So that's the circumstance here. The soul wanting, let me out of here. But it's perfectly understandable. He's not a yogi, he's not saying, he's not Shukadeva Swami. In the womb, out of the womb is the same. It's all one. Because he was already liberated. But here's the soul wanting relief from distress. Just as Krishna says, that's one of the impetuses for devotional service. Four types of people that engage in devotional service initially. One of them is those who are in distress. They want relief from distress. So, moksha kama. Then there's sarva kama. The classic example of the sarva kama bhakta. The devotee has all desires. Sarva kama is Dhruva Maharaj. He wanted the carrot he was chasing was a kingdom. He got it. But that was his impetus, Sarvakama. But he became in Tibra Bhakti, very, very strong devotion to Lord Vishnu, and became freed from that desire. And then there's the Akama, which we're encouraged to go towards. But whether one has Sarvakama or Moksha Kama, all desires are the desire for liberation, like this living entity here. Tibra Bhakti, strong devotional service. That is what someone will take up if they have Uttaradi, they have magnanimous intelligence that makes their life auspicious because of taking shelter of the personality of Godhead, which the soul is doing. Unfortunately, he forgets after he gets released from that circumstance. Okay, so we'll end there and see if there's discussion. Yes?
I was just thinking that it is quite strange that the consciousness which is emanating from the pure soul, which is considered to be the most powerful energy, and that gets covered over by something which is inferior. Like when we are usually describing the susupti stage or the sleep state, we tend to evaluate the how much consciousness is there in terms of the quality of the mind, intelligence, and the false ego. Like how much the...
how dense it is. Yeah.
Right. The question that I was having was, someone lost it.
Should we wait and come back?
I would have somebody else. I'm okay. Just thinking.
Yeah.
Ramad, I was like contemplating about emotional sense gratification.
Emotional sense gratification.
Yeah, because it's, well, I guess it's more subtle than...
Yes, it's more subtle.
Sense gratification, and then how do you identify you're indulging in emotional sense gratification as opposed to... that's still being enjoyed.
It's related to his question. It's the spirit of... how much am I thinking Krishna should be pleased? And conversely, how much am I thinking I'm at the center and I'm being pleased by this? Let's just take happiness in the mode of goodness. Being charitable. Everybody knows what that feeling is of doing something for others, sacrificing to do something for others. And there's a certain happiness, mode of goodness happiness. That's just as an example. So that's this mental gratification. The happiness of the mode of goodness is a mental gratification. It's not God is at the center. Then there may be degrees of how God is at the center. And, you know, going brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter until it's just God that's at the center. That's pure. That's shuddha. Not goodness. So mental gratification is where we're at the center. And the converse is we're not at the center. There's happiness. But the happiness is that Krishna is pleased. And then a symptom that it's really happiness that Krishna is pleased, that there's no envy. Someone else pleases Krishna, we're thinking Krishna's happiness. Not, oh, let me compete with that person that's making Krishna happy. Or find fault with the person or something, you know, something that obscures the center of Krishna's happiness. Then otherwise it's on the material platform, but it proportionally to Krishna not being at the center. And you know, you take it to degrees, like the gopis that were ready to go to hell for giving the dust from the lotus feet, if the dust from the lotus feet would cure Krishna's headache, no problem, take it, we'll experience whatever. Just Krishna's happiness is at the center. So that's extraordinary. But from our position, who's at the center? Whose happiness is really what's important? Because we want happiness. It comes down to we want happiness. And how do we look for it? Krishna at the center, or me, or somewhere in the spectrum in between. You have to speak a little louder.
To love is to give, Maharaj. So, loving is to give. It's all about giving.
Loving
is all about giving.
Service. Loving or service or both?
Both.
Okay.
So when.
Well, it's not all about giving. There's also reciprocating when one receives.
Yeah, that was a question. So when we are expecting any reciprocation, is it? How do we differentiate it between expecting respect and just wanting reciprocation?
Expecting respect or
reciprocation.
Expecting
is
reciprocation.
Expecting reciprocation.
As you said, that loving is also about.
Well, what does Chaitanya Mahaprabhu say about that? Well, that's our standard. There is the light that we hold things up to. Lord Chaitanya's teaching: Amanina Manadena. And as long as I offer respect, or I offer service, or I offer love, or I offer something, and I'm expecting something back, then it's not pure. And then the pain of suffering will come because it didn't come. I had this expectation. What Krishna says to the gopis is what Krishna says to the gopis is, I have no capacity to repay you. Maybe you remember this from the prayers of Lord Brahma. One of his prayers, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, is this saying and commenting about Lord Brahma's prayers, how you would reciprocate with these residents of Vrindavan. Look how you reciprocated with Putana, and she came to kill you. But the residents of Vrindavan, they don't have any of that. How are you going to reciprocate with them? And the answer is, he can't. Or that is, he gives himself. Like the discussion yesterday with Ram. How can I repay you? I can just embrace you. So that's how the Lord reciprocates. But if one has an expectation of something or something or something, and it doesn't happen that way, then, you know, the mind, you know, the mental happiness disappears. Because I had an expectation. My mind was on the material platform. Even the service that I was offering was on the material platform. I was expecting something. Whether it's respect or acknowledgement. In terms of Krishna certainly acknowledges, but it may appear that Krishna is neglecting. It's not Krishna neglecting, like Krishna didn't go back to Vrindavan. But it wasn't that he was neglecting. There was another transcendental purpose involved in it. So, in our practical dealings, besides with Krishna, just with one another, having an expectation is part of our contamination. It pollutes the relationship. It's not a true serving and loving relationship. We're still at the center, to at least to a degree. Did you remember the questions? Okay.
So my question was, how do we experience the fullness of our consciousness? Is it through the experience of how we are able to utilize the subtle body, like mind is able to be led by strong desire to serve Krishna, intelligence is operative in terms of detailed planning about how to serve Krishna, the ego is clear that I am a servant of Krishna. Is that what is the real experience of the fullness of, or full manifestation of soul's consciousness?
You sound a little complicated. Pratiti is pretty simple. Like the spark put back in the fire from which it came, the glowing capacity of the spark is at its maximum. Put it back in the fire. So that's how we are fully immersed, absorbed, you know, in the shelter of Krishna. That's the fullness of consciousness. That's how. What that's like depends upon how Krishna reciprocates with us. And what our spiritual constitution and position of service is. It may be this or that. For Krishna's pleasure. And there's only one thing, Krishna's pleasure. And that's our happiness. That's the fullness of consciousness. Okay? Dinishna, you're the only one.
Okay. I was thinking when you were speaking, Guru Maharaj, that it's like when you have a radio and, you know, the sounds are distorted if you don't have it properly aligned in the right
signal is not good.
Yeah, signal is not good.
A little more static this way, a little more static that way, distortion. Then you get it right, and then it's a clear signal.
There's nothing else to do.
That's a good one.
The pure consciousness is we are servant of Krishna. We are not Chinese or American. We are not white or black.
Yes.
We are servant of Krishna. But sometimes I feel even we are servant of Krishna is an idea, is a conception.
I got you.
But there's no realization because we say we are servant of Krishna, but we don't know what to do. We don't know how to serve. It's kind of like given to us. This is an idea.
I understand.
It's external, but not internal.
I understand your message.
How to deal with it?
In one word, anushilana, in the Sanskrit word, means cultivate. Prabhupada writes this in the introduction to Nectar of Devotion, and he's explaining the central verse of the entire Nectar of Devotion, which describes bhakti as a type of cultivation. So, you ever done gardening? Ever grown things in the garden? Ever? Never. Too busy with your studies to do that. Ever grown anything in a garden?
Garden. Have you grown anything in the garden?
No. So when you do gardening, or let's say you want some sprouts, you ever sprouted beans, long beans, or any kind of sprouts, or whatever. Have you seen it? Okay. It starts with a seed. And the seed has a hard covering. It serves a purpose. The covering protects the life that's inside. So water, you know, things, you can't, it's protected. But the consciousness of that living entity that's inside is dormant. And it can sit in a bag, or on a shelf, or in a jar, or like for a long time. And then comes, okay, let's germinate the seed, or the bean, or whatever it is. So, place it in some moist situation, make an atmosphere that's suitable for germinating the seed. And, you know, life starts to activate inside. know, the life inside starts to grow and the shell becomes softened, the shell falls off. And then the life grows and grows and grows and grows. So if you're good at gardening or good at cultivating, you continue to put that seed in a place that's now sprouting in some soil. Initially it may just be on a cloth or some kind of medium for keeping moisture and sunlight, and then put in soil and roots can grow, and it's a cultivation, gradual. So in the beginning of bhakti, it's like that. In the beginning, we engage in activities that, like sprouting the seed before we plant the seed. It's just the hearing and chanting is the primary nourishment, like the moisture and sunlight. For us, it's hearing and chanting. And it awakens the consciousness, dormant consciousness of the soul. And then things that we hear start with something that's notional only. Like you say, outside. It's a concept. Nice concept. I'm attracted to that nice concept. I don't feel it inside. I haven't fully realized it inside. But it resonates. It's right. So now your question is what to do. Continue the hearing and chanting process. And avoid offenses. When you put a plant into the soil, there's animals that can come along and eat the plant. Rabbits and all kinds of. So you build a little fence. Keep the creatures out. Sometimes they jump over the fence. They build a tall fence. We may even, you know, some chicken wire, you know, some fun wire that keeps the living entities. There's a devotee in St. Louis, Dr. Mike, and he was doing some gardening in the back. But, you know, as soon as something, here come, you know, the squirrels and the yum, 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 and nothing grew. So now we have chicken wire. Box, you know, there's the soil still there and everything's planted, but they can't get in. So in the beginning, we continue to hear and chant, but we also make some fences and, you know, protect that paper of bhakti so that others can't interfere. You know, with they don't have to be predatorial, they can be with good intention, but we don't go here and there and hear from this one now and spin out and wonder, whoa, I'm feeling seasick. Want to vomit. What's going on? We're careful. And we're careful about offenses. We may not understand A to Z about offenses, but we hear we should guard against offenses. And there are consequences if one doesn't. They're real consequences if one doesn't heed that warning, guard against offenses. They're going to happen to some degree anyway because we're still covered. We don't really, light's not fully bright. But we should be careful. And when we see that that offense has been made, we want to address it and not repeat it. So that's, you know, that's responsible life in the life of cultivating, you know, in response to your question. To going from notional to realized. It's there. It's of the soul. It's not just something that's out there. It's there already. But we haven't realized it yet. We just continue the process of growing. And bhakti is the medium for that realization. And bhakti means we want to serve with love. Serve with love. That's bhakti. And we just orient everything towards that one thing. Whether it's our relationships, whether it's career, whether it's, you know, this or that. It's oriented towards one thing. And something that interferes with that one thing, we, with a big smile, we say, no, thank you. I want this one thing. At least I want to cultivate this one thing. And as that matures, then the realization comes. It's not just notional anymore. Gradually. Maybe too gradually for our liking, but gradually. Just like Prabhupada gives the comparison to the rising of the sun. It's gradual. The sun will keep rising. Then eventually the full brightness of the midday sun, everything becomes very clear. So until then, the proximate relationships of persons guiding the development of your bhakti become really important. Not take it or leave it, optional, very important. And when one becomes mature, it's not like, no, I don't need that relationship anymore. Thanks a lot, see you later. It's not like that. That's impersonal. Personal is that as I come closer and closer to Krishna, I value all the more and all the more and all the more those relationships, because that's where the mercy of Krishna flows into my life. There may be this or that or the other manifestation of mercy in my life, but it's because of these very kind persons guiding that I'm receiving this mercy. Krishna is smiling. And Krishna is sending this and that and the other resource to help me progress in Krishna consciousness. And if one of those things comes along that's not going to help me in my Krishna consciousness, and I'm kind of like a little dull that I don't really understand what's good for my Krishna consciousness and not good for my Krishna consciousness, I just turn to them and seek their confirmation. And I'm guided that way. That's the responsibility of cultivating our garden. We look to expert other gardeners. I mean, I don't know so much about it, but a little bit I know about it. The people that do gardening, there are certain, when you want to grow this, there are certain other kinds of plants that you also want to put nearby because they could help protect the thing that you want from certain insects and certain diseases and certain other things. There's a science to it. If you don't know the science, the thing that you want may get, you know, destroyed just by the course of nature. And so being under the guidance of persons that know how to cultivate properly, that's good. And most importantly, Krishna is pleased by that. Most importantly. Okay? We're good? Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Minutes, Rupa, say whatever.